You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As we talk travel and COVID-19, as we just heard, a third case of coronavirus has been confirmed in Wisconsin. The person was exposed while traveling in the U.S. And according to state officials, the patient is currently isolated at home. The federal government has issued a number of travel advisories, level 3 being the highest. COVID-19 has changed air travel. Airlines have cut domestic and international flights as we see fewer passengers taking to the sky. Are you someone who's canceled a flight or changed a trip because of COVID-19? What is it like working with the airlines right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Seth Kaplan is an aviation journalist with Kaplan Research. He's founding editor of Airline Weekly. Seth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good to be here, Kate. How are you?
I'm doing well. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is recommending that people avoid non-essential travel to countries like China and Iran, South Korea, Italy. How is that directly affecting the overall airline industry as you see it right now?
Well, there's a lot of impact. Those are large markets. I mean, especially China. Italy's a big one, too, even more so as you get toward the summer peak. But the bigger impact now is that people seem to be afraid to travel almost anywhere. So even a giant market like China, if it had been limited to that, you know, which a month ago seemed plausible, even the U.S. airlines that fly there, you know, the Deltas, Uniteds, and Americans of the world, would have managed through that just fine. And then if it had just been Italy. Destinations for travelers are somewhat what you call substitutable. So as tragic as it is when something goes wrong in one place, yeah, of course, you have some business travel stop to that place. But, you know, leisure travelers, instead of going to Italy, if this were only about Italy, would just go somewhere else, and the airlines would get that business anyway. But, of course, this has now gone well beyond that, and very clearly fewer people are flying, and even fewer people are booking future travel.
So as you see it, what is the risk to flying right now, whether it's domestically or internationally?
In most cases, it's the same risk as being with a large group of people in a small space anywhere else. I think there was always this kind of myth about airplane air, it's dirty recirculated air. Not really. It actually is mostly fresh air, filtered using kind of hospital standard filtration and all that. The air itself is fine. The risk is that you're with a whole lot of people in a small space. And so what I've been telling people is that, look, think about what else you're doing in your life. And if you've made the personal choice that you just don't want to be with large groups of people because you are elderly, or because you have a compromised immune system, or because you take care of somebody who has one of those things and you don't want to get sick and get them sick, then absolutely. If you don't want to be in a movie theater full of people, then you probably also don't want to be on an airplane full of people. But the thing to understand is that the risk is very similar there. You know, if the person sitting next to you in that movie theater is sick, you're vulnerable, you know, whether it's coronavirus or something else. The coronavirus is not airborne, so if the person sitting next to you or if somebody's sitting 15 rows in back of you on a flight sneezes, you're probably not going to get it just because of that. Just like if somebody sneezes 15 rows back of you in the movie theater, you're probably not going to get it. So the risk is that you're with a whole bunch of people, who have come from different places, obviously, in the case of an airplane. So that's kind of how I look at that. I personally, right now, would still get on a flight. I don't happen to have any travel scheduled in the next week or so, but knowing what I know today, I would get on a flight. And again, that's just because I personally would still go to the movies, right? But it's tough, right? This is different from the post 9/11 period.
Yeah,
I realize now enough years have gone by that we have listeners who don't remember that. But I remember after that, awful as the situation was, I was traveling everywhere after that, paying almost nothing, empty flights, and thinking to myself, this is probably the safest I've ever been because of all the new security, right? This is a little bit different, right? Because coronavirus, even though most of us, might not get it, and if we do, we might be okay, if we're not very young or very old, and if we're healthy and all that, it's real. I mean, people really are contracting it. Some people really are dying from it. And so it is a little bit different and very much a personal decision.
Well, let's pause right there with Seth Kaplan, a transportation analyst. He is also a founding editor of Airline Weekly. We're looking at the risks of air travel right now. Are you someone who has had to cancel a flight or change a trip because of COVID-19? Or perhaps you canceled a cruise recently. What was that ordeal like? Tell us your situation, what you're seeing. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Seth, you were going there in the history of those major issues within flying in the airline industry. You mentioned 9/11 terrorist attacks. In 2009, there was the H1N1 flu pandemic. How would you compare that event with what these airlines are seeing now?
This is about as bad as it's been. Now, the H1N1 is a little bit of a tough one to measure because that was also in the middle of a global recession. Mm. So, you know, travel was down for all kinds of reasons then. But as far as we can tell, this is about as bad as it's been. And it's not just some sort of overreaction or hysteria on the part of travelers. This epidemic itself really is worse than others in measurable ways. SARS back in 2003 was actually the one that had the greatest economic impact on the airline industry. And that one caused about $7 billion in direct damage to the airline industry. You know, and there was other, you know, there's always cascading effects beyond that on hotels and everybody else involved, but about $7 billion, most of which was concentrated in Asia. And even the $1 billion in North America was mainly concentrated in Canada. So it would be, there was a big outbreak in Toronto.
There's a big outbreak in your house.
Yeah, exactly.
No, carry on. We love mornings. Absolutely. Don't worry.
Getting ready for school here.
That's good. How has the industry, how much money could airliners lose due to coronavirus?
Well, the IATA, which is the Global Airline Industry Association, had calculated that if this looked something like SARS, which I just said that was like a $7 billion issue, that this would have caused like almost $30 billion in damage. So what they were doing there was saying, okay, let's say this epidemic looks like SARS, but we take into account the fact that China is a much bigger market now, and you know, just the world work has far more connected now, people travel more. So they already assumed that this would be a far bigger problem today, even if this looked something like SARS. But now we know that the epidemic itself, you know, there are more diagnoses, there are more deaths already, right? Not even knowing what else is going to happen. And that same organization came out last week and said, look, this could be more than $100 billion in impact. And again, we're just talking about airlines, right? Mm-hmm. We're not talking about all the other
modes of travel and economic.
Other modes of travel, right. Not to mention all the other economic impact, which is also a vicious cycle, right? Because travel demand doesn't just depend on people not being afraid to fly. It also depends on people having money, right? And so, you know, as people check their 401k balances and see what has happened over the past few weeks, or as they worry about their jobs in some cases and all that, you know, even people who haven't suffered yet, just the fear of economic issues causes people to tighten their belts.
We have to pause right there as we talk about air travel with Seth Kaplan. He's an aviation journalist. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about how to stay healthy if you board a plane. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So once upon a time, it seemed excessive to wipe down your personal space on a plane. In the wake of coronavirus, the practice is now being recommended by health professionals. Some people are choosing to forgo air travel during this health crisis. Other people continue to fly. Are you a frequent flyer? What advice do you have for how to stay well as you travel through airports and board planes? Do you work in the industry? What have you seen firsthand since the COVID-19 outbreak? We're at 800-642-1234. Aviation analyst Seth Kaplan is here, and he stays with us. Let's take a call now. Chessie is with us from Madison. Hi, Chessie.
Hi. I was just calling because I'm looking to book a couple of flights for the summer, and it doesn't seem like prices have moved at all. And I'm just curious why the airlines are not reducing prices when demand is low, and if you think they will.
Hi, Chessie. Well, it kind of depends on the market. I actually booked a flight the other day for as far out as October, where the fare had just completely crashed. So it's an uneven effect right now. Airlines are focusing first on flights here in the next couple months, where they just know clearly they're behind in what they consider the booking curve, as they call it, right? A flight should have this number of people on it, and it doesn't, and you know, how do you get people on? You discount it. Airlines are being a little bit more conservative about the summer because, look, there's a scenario where things, maybe even if they don't get completely better, where they stabilize to the point where people feel okay about traveling again a couple months from now, and where airlines might at that point be sorry to have kind of given away all the seats at really low fares. So I think that's what you see them playing, is that game where sort of what they consider the more marginal stuff, you know, the stuff that's unlikely to go, is where they'll discount it real deeply. And like I said, that can be an October flight, but maybe not a July flight, you know, just because the travel demand is lower then. Yeah, I saw some crazy low flights. I live in Washington, D.C. Most of our families are down in Florida. I happened to see, you know, $64 round trip from Fort Lauderdale to Baltimore, Washington. I called my parents. I said, hey, you know, fly up for dinner if you want. You know, obviously it's been many years since we've seen fares like those. That was for May that I was checking there. So there are some crazy low deals out there, but then you're right. I talked yesterday to a friend who had booked something to Hawaii right before all this started, and I said, hey, check and see if it's gone down, because with the flexibility, you might be able to get some money back. He said, yeah, it went down $50, but it was still a rather expensive flight. That's for several months from now.
Chessie, thanks for the call. Let's bring in Doug now, joining us from Lansing, Iowa. Hi, Doug.
Hello. How are you today?
Doing well. What's on your mind about travel?
Well, I was going to go down to Phoenix next month because my friends are going to Greece, and I'm really wondering why they're going. But I just wanted to comment that a lot of people are going on trips, and it's sort of, if you don't go, your friends are saying, what's the matter with you and stuff like that? You should still go. There's not a problem, because everybody has their opinions on how bad the virus is going to be. But my one comment is, I'm 77 and I have a compromised system, is why would anybody want to go anywhere else but around their home when their local hospital is the best one to treat them? You know, in this area we have Mayo Clinic and stuff like that. Why would you want to go to Athens, Greece, and come down with the virus?
So, that's Doug, you're not caving into any peer pressure from your friends, it sounds like.
No, I'm not. But I am really worried that, you know, if you get it, you're going to be in a hospital that you don't know someplace around the world. The other day I was listening to a doctor about this. He said, I can't tell you how dangerous this is for people over the age of 70. And he said, you know, the coronavirus is going to be like the angel of death for older people.
Well, Doug, thank you for calling in. Seth, you know, Doug being 77, he is really thinking about safety here, staying close to home.
Yeah, smart to think about it. He raises that issue, right? It's not just the chances that something go wrong. It's that then what happens if something does go wrong, right? And there might be places where you feel better about, depending on the medical care, than others. And that's definitely a part of the equation. And like I said, this is a tricky one. I don't know what to tell people because, hey, even like I said, if you're healthy, but you're, I've heard people say this, hey, I'm okay, right? I'm middle-aged and healthy, but I take care of a parent who's not, so I don't want to be exposed and then expose them because of that long incubation period, right? You can certainly understand somebody saying that. So as I said, generally, I just kind of view travel as everything else. If you are avoiding crowds in general, then, yeah, there's a crowd of people on that 737 that you're going to get on just as anywhere else. If you're around lots of people because you're fighting for, I don't know, masks at Walmart, the irony is you're probably just as likely to contract somebody from all the people around you there as you are somewhere else. So it's just kind of, how many people do you want to be around? And if you want to stay away from people, then an airplane is probably not a place you want to be.
We're talking with transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, looking at air travel here during COVID-19, how airlines are reacting. Have you recently returned from a trip overseas? What safety precautions have you seen airlines or passengers taking? Did you face any type of quarantine situation? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Becky now in Waterford. Hi, Becky.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So my cousins and I are going to New York, which seems to be coronavirus central, the first week of April. And I'm really excited. I still want to go. My plane is paid for. Our Airbnb apartment is paid for. But I'm really kind of just taken aback at how much fear and panic people have over a virus. And they're actually allowing themselves to not travel, to stay home, and to miss out on fun things. So I'm really hoping that my trip goes through. I still want to go. I'm not going to be ignorant to the fact that there's a virus out there, but I don't think we need to become hermits over it and not live life.
Becky, thank you. Seth, Becky's saying, look, be reasonable.
And, I will say this. What I mentioned before, just sort of you're on a plane with all those people, I mean, in some small way, obviously I'm not an epidemiologist here, but I know that the reason you get sick on planes is typically because of a person sitting next to you who's sick, right, or somebody very close to you. The reality is that right now there aren't as many people on airplanes. So, and there was a study a couple of years ago out of Emory University that found that people sitting on the window on flights tend to get sick at slightly lower rates than people sitting in other seats. Nothing magical about the window. It's just that, you don't have people around you on all sides, right? You're not exposed to as much. And I have to tell you, I was actually talking earlier with Jeremy Hobson, the host of NPR's Here Now, getting ready for my segment there later today. Jeremy was on a flight from Washington to Boston, told me there were 8 people on that flight. So that tells us a couple things. First of all, that is a data point, along with other people I've talked to that have given me different reports about anything from sort of half-full flights down to that's the most extreme one I've heard of somebody I know and have talked to personally. The other thing is that when there are 8 people on the flight, there just aren't as many people around you, right? So the reality is that for whatever the reason, tragic as it is, if you're on an empty flight and you're going to empty public spaces because nobody else is going there, then the risk to some degree anyway is probably somewhat lower. Again, a personal choice still, but the reality is there are fewer people out there.
Let's go to Nate now in Eau Claire. Good morning, Nate.
Good morning. I'm a physician, and I have friends and colleagues in China I've been talking to. I think that we need to look to Italy and see that that's probably where we will be in the next few weeks to months. I mean, it's probably safe to fly now. It's not just the flying. It's the traveling around the country. It's intermixing groups of people. I think, we may be able to choose to fly for another few weeks. We'll probably face a situation where we're not allowed to fly in the not-too-distant future. We're looking at a disease that's probably 30 to 50 times more deadly than the flu. And, to travel for entertainment or for fun, I think, is probably reckless.
Nate, have you made your travel plans or any travel plans recently?
No, I have a conference coming up at the end of April, but I'm almost certain that'll be canceled. A big physician conference at the end of this month was canceled. I think, to imagine that our experience will be dramatically different than China's or Italy's or some other countries, probably unfounded, right? There's no reason to believe we won't go down the same path. So I think, you know, and for 6 weeks from now, 3 months from now to travel, you know, you're really going against the odds. You're going against what logic would tell you is going to happen. So I think it's unrealistic.
Nate, thank you for calling in. And Seth, in the last few moments here, and Nate has mentioned conferences are being canceled.
Right.
And Nate says, you know, air travel just absolutely maybe shut down as we know it in the coming weeks.
Yeah, and organizations have a different sort of calculation when they decide what to do. It's one thing for us personally, you know, for me to say, okay, I'm willing to get on an airplane or I'm willing to take my family on an airplane, you know, understanding the risk. But, you know, companies have what's called a duty of care, right? They have liability. And it's a whole other thing to tell somebody, hey, you have to go to this meeting, knowing the risk that's out there. And knowing, as they said, you know, we don't know. When people ask me, you know, how's this going to play out? I say, hey, you tell me how the virus is going to play out, and I'll tell you the rest of it, right? And that's not to be flippant, but what I mean is the biggest variable of all, we really don't know.
We have to leave it there. Seth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Seth Kaplan is an aviation journalist with Kaplan Research. He is the transportation analyst for NPR's show Here and Now. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers has signed a bill creating 12 new circuit court branches over the next several years, and it's a move that aims to address backlogs in the state judicial system. This is the first expansion of the state court system in a decade. Have you experienced a delay in a legal proceeding? Attorneys, let's hear from you. What could be done to improve local courts? Have court dates been in a reasonable amount of time for your clients? We're at 800-642-1234. Judge Randy Koshnick is director of state courts and is the top non-judicial officer in the court system. He works with chief justices in Wisconsin's 9 judicial administrative districts and is responsible for personnel, budgeting, and IT. He came to the post in 2017. Judge Koshnick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Good morning, Kate.
Well, let's start with what circuit court branches do. Tell us what goes on in the circuit courts.
Circuit courts are the general jurisdiction courts in Wisconsin, so they would handle a wide variety of cases you might read about in the newspaper. Criminal cases, family cases, including divorce, civil cases, you know, car accidents, medical malpractice, contract disputes, probate matters involving trust in the states. And small claims cases, those are the main categories. There's a number of other lesser-known categories. But you most likely have contact in Wisconsin if you go to court with a circuit court.
Governor Evers signed this legislation to create 12 new circuit court branches over the next 3 years. Why are these new courts needed?
Well, a number of demands are being placed on the system, and in certain areas of the state, we've had backlogs developing, resulting in cases being delayed. One of the big factors in the past several years has been the heroin, opioid, meth crisis, especially in some of our more rural counties. And so that has a related impact on the number of crimes that are committed and criminal cases that are charged. And so my office, among other things, you know, monitors the court's performance on a daily basis. We haven't had new judgeships added to Wisconsin in 10 years. And so we really had reached a point about 2 or 3 years ago when we decided we needed to go to the legislature and the governor and ask for new branches in some specific counties.
So when you say a backlog, I can't visualize that. What does that mean for these judges in parts of the state?
Well, it's similar to a doctor's office, I suppose, would be a good analogy. You've got so many hours in the day you can hold court, typically 8 hours a day to hold court sessions. And so the more cases you have, you know, the more slots you have to find for those cases. You need to make sure that the litigants in each case are given a full opportunity to be heard. And so you can't really compartmentalize hearings into specific time periods without, in many cases, depriving someone of their right to be heard. And related to the opioid and meth crisis, we've been really trying to develop treatment courts around the state. And these are effective at reducing recidivism and providing rehabilitation opportunities to nonviolent criminal offenders. But they're also much more time-consuming for the court system. And so as you have more complicated hearings that take more judicial resources, you can see how the scheduling would be affected, and it would take longer and longer to get into court in front of a judge.
Why are treatment courts more time-consuming? What is going on in these types of cases that is different from others?
Treatment courts have been proven by research and data that's been done around the country to be very effective at reducing recidivism by providing court-monitored counseling rehabilitation services. And so in a typical nonviolent felony case where the person enters a plea as opposed to have a trial, it might take 2 or 3 hours of court time. The person has a few preliminary hearings, pleads guilty, gets sentenced. It might be 2 or 3 hours of court time. With a treatment court program, that defendant is appearing in front of that judge perhaps every week, maybe every other week, depending on his or her progress, and that can last for anywhere from 1 to 2 years. So you can see how there would be an exponential increase in the demand on the court system. A typical nonviolent felony case would take 2 or 3 hours under the traditional process. It might take 12 or 15 or 20 hours of court time under the treatment court process. And so that has an effect when it's spread across thousands of cases around the state.
We're talking with Judge Randy Koshnick, Wisconsin's Director of State Courts. We're talking about Assembly Bill 470, which creates 12 new circuit court branches in our state. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Have you seen the backlog where you are? Are there things that could be improved in local courts? What things are they doing right in your courtroom? Do you need another court where you live? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Judge Koshnick, you have to consider factors as where you put these new courts. What are you looking at?
Well, some of the main factors would be the judicial workload. So many of these counties that are receiving new branches are 1, 2, or 3 judge counties. Many of them are rural counties. And in many of these counties, the judges are at 150% of a normal caseload. So not only are they working very hard, which they don't mind, but there aren't enough hours in the day to get all the cases on the calendar. So judicial workload is one of the primary factors. Whether the county is developing a treatment court, because we're trying to encourage treatment courts, and we need to give judges the resources to do a good job with the treatment courts. When you're running a treatment court, there are scientifically established standards you have to follow to make sure you do things right. And so you can't take shortcuts, because that can result in actually doing harm rather than doing good. And so we look at whether they're developing a treatment court. We look at the county resources as well. You know, so a county, if they're going to receive a new judgeship, has to have a courtroom for the judge. The judgeship bill essentially provides state funding to pay the judge's salary and benefits and the salary and benefits for the judge's court reporter. Everything else really falls on the county. So the county has to build the courtroom, provide security, typically by a bailiff through the sheriff's office. Clerk of court needs to be staffing the court as well. So it's a state-county partnership. We need to make sure that the county is ready to have that court in operation. Another major factor is regional needs. We might have a number of one-judge counties that are all experiencing backlogs. So if we can strategically create a new branch in that group of counties, that judge actually can be assigned to cases in nearby counties to help relieve their backlogs as well. So regional need is another factor that we consider.
So far, for the first 4 new court branches for 2021, you've chosen Calumet, Dunn, Jackson, and Marathon counties. As you work with these counties, do they have the resources to support a new court?
Yes, they do. We've been working on this formally for the past 3 years. And so my district court administrators, who are local administrators basically, are working with the counties and the judges in these individual counties to make sure that they have the facilities that are ready. So those 4 counties, many of them, 3 of them actually have had courtrooms ready for more than 5 years. So there have been repeated attempts at a judgeship bill. It's difficult to get a bill through the legislature and to the governors, you might imagine. Most bills, I think, that are generated don't result in the law being passed. So yes, those counties are ready right now. I've got 8 more I'm considering for the next 3 years overall. Some of them are still in the development and building process. We'll be monitoring them to make sure they're ready to receive and accommodate the judgeship before they're actually officially named.
Well, let's take a call now. Rick is joining us from Holman this morning. Hi, Rick.
Well, good morning.
Go ahead. What's your question?
Yeah, I have a question for you, sir. It was a few months ago. I was woken up at 3 a.m, walked out my door, and there's 8 police cars. And my house was surrounded by SWAT, full gear. They also came in my house without a warrant, took a gun and a knife, and I still won't have them back. And this was back in October, and the police still have them. Because apparently you passed a law that says you have to get fingerprinted to get stuff out of evidence. So I'm just, I didn't think we had red flag laws yet.
So Rick is concerned about the time it takes, once items are confiscated, like weapons, the time it takes to, in the process of getting these items back. Judge, can you comment on that?
Well, I need to be clear. I'm not allowed to comment on any individual or specific case, because even though I'm an administrator, I'm still a judge. And so judges are ethically prohibited in Wisconsin from commenting on individual cases that may be pending. In a general sense, what we're talking about here is really a law enforcement issue as far as the items being seized and being kept in evidence. There is a provision in state law for a person or citizen whose property has been taken by law enforcement to request the court to return the items. It's a pretty simple procedure. It's always best to have a lawyer to handle a legal matter, but you're not legally required to have a lawyer. So the person files a written request with the court, identifying the property that was seized, when it was seized, which law enforcement agency seized it. And then typically the judge will schedule a hearing. The district attorney will come in with the police and either agree to return the evidence or explain to the judge why they need the evidence to investigate or prosecute a case. So there is an orderly process that's available. And I would recommend that somebody in that situation at least consult with a lawyer for guidance on how best to pursue retrieving their property.
Judge Koshnick, as you look at the setup of these new courts, you mentioned the state pays for the new judge and the court reporter, but the county picks up the other costs like the clerk and the bailiff. What about the attorneys involved here, especially the public defenders? Will there be enough public defenders to be able to adequately staff these new courts?
Well, that's a good point. The district attorneys and the public defenders in Wisconsin are paid for the most part by the state. Like many things in the Wisconsin court system are a partnership between the state and the county. But the DAs and the ADAs, assistant district attorneys, are state employees. Staff public defenders are also state-paid attorneys. Some public defender cases are assigned out to private lawyers who are paid with a combination of state and county funds to take those cases. So as part of this overall court package, the legislature did and the governor did grant 60-plus new assistant district attorney positions around the state. They also increased the private bar rate. So the state was paying private lawyers who take public defender cases $40 an hour up until last year. And that was really inadequate to cover a lawyer's actual expenses in most cases. I think it was the lowest of the nation. Now it's $70 an hour, so that's a pretty significant increase. You're not going to get rich doing those cases as a lawyer, but many lawyers, you know, understand their obligation to contribute to the system and to take cases for less than they could probably charge a private paying client in order to serve the public. And
we have to pause there with Judge Randy Koshnick, with Director of State Courts. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about what's behind the creation of 12 new circuit court branches in Wisconsin. Our state currently has 249 judges, and the last circuit court branch was added in 2010 when a judicial assessment showed a need for 18 more judges. Do you work in the court system? Do you feel overwhelmed by many more drug-related cases? Will additional judges address the issue, or do you see a need for other supports in the system? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Judge Randy Koshnick is Director of State Courts, and he stays with us. Judge Koshnick, when you mentioned there that some judges are at 150% caseload, are you worried at all that justice is being compromised, that we are carrying out people's rights accordingly?
Very much so. I mean, adherence to the constitutional requirements is the primary thing that I do in the court system. We need to make sure that we protect individual rights and uphold the rule of law. So there are other things that I can do for a judge who's overworked. We have retired judges called reserve judges. They're sort of like substitute teachers. I can hire them on a daily basis to fill in where extra help is needed. So one of the counties that's getting a new judgeship, for example, Marathon County, had a pretty big backlog. And so what I did is, working with the local judges and my local administrators, we appointed a reserve judge to go there 1 or 2 days every week and to run an extra courtroom to help process some of these cases. So, yes, I'm very sensitive to people waiting for hearings, especially when there's a liberty interest at stake. If you have a person in jail who's not been convicted, they're presumed innocent, they're in jail usually because of a cash bail that's been set. We need to make sure that their case is processed in a timely manner. And so we do place a priority on cases involving liberty interests. And I can also transfer judges between counties. So if one judge in one county has a very large workload and the other county judge perhaps does not have a full workload, I can send that second judge to the first county to help out.
Explain where the new judges for these courts come from and how the elections work.
Well, judges in Wisconsin are nonpartisan officers, and so we have our nonpartisan elections in Wisconsin in the spring. And the way this judgeship bill will work is, in spring of 2021, we'll have the four new judgeships on the ballot. If there's more than two people running for each position, we have a primary election in February. And then the top two vote-getters in the primary stand in the general election, which is in April. And so they will be elected for six-year terms. If there's a vacancy during the middle of a term, then the governor appoints someone to fill in the vacancy until the term is up for election the next time.
Do you find, as a judge, that there is interest in serving in these capacities, in these positions?
Oh, yes. I think that most lawyers aspire to be a judge at some point. It is a position of great honor and great public service. You're deciding really important matters for people, members in your community. If you want to be a circuit court judge, you need to be a resident of that county to serve. So when I was on the bench in Jefferson County for 18 years, I lived in Jefferson County. I ran for election every 6 years. I'd go out and meet the people at various, you know, meetings and organizations to stay in touch with them. And yes, I think that that's very important for judges to stay in touch with the people that they serve.
Talking with Judge Randy Koshnick, director of the state court system since 2017, looking at Governor Evers signing legislation recently creating 12 new circuit court branches in Wisconsin over the next 3 years and what that means. Still time for your thoughts on this, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Judge Koshnick, some would think that having more courts and more judges and more cases means more people being sent to prison. Do you see a connection there?
I can see where people might intuitively reach that conclusion, but what the data tells us is that that's not necessarily the case. And so one of the beautiful things here, Kate, was that not only did we have broad bipartisan support for the judgeship bill and the assistant district attorney positions, we also had all three branches of government involved and working together, collaborating to find solutions that make sense. So when Governor Evers signed the judgeship bill in Wausau last week on Thursday, we had many judges there. We had the governor there, members of his staff, and also several legislators. So it was bipartisan and all three branches of Wisconsin government working together. And what the research tells us with these treatment courts especially is, if you treat someone who has a drug addiction problem that causes them to engage in criminal behavior, if you treat them effectively following established standards, you can decrease the likelihood that they need to be incarcerated for a lengthy period of time. So we're actually hoping to drive down the number of people in prison, or the length of time that people need to serve in prison, because they obviously pose less of a risk to the public if they've been effectively treated and assisted in finding, you know, employment or other productive means of contributing to society. So I'm hoping that we can drive down incarceration costs and redirect those resources to rehabilitation, reduce recidivism, help the individual, improve public safety. It's a win-win.
Do you see treatment courts as the way of the future here in Wisconsin as we look at this opioid epidemic and how to address it?
I do. I mean, we had a treatment court when I was on the bench in Jefferson County. We had an OWI treatment court. So it was an alcohol offense treatment court. And I saw individuals come through with repeat drunk driving offenses who, under the old system, would have been locked in for a long time in jail or prison, maybe receive treatment, maybe not, get out to reoffend again because the underlying issue was never resolved. With the treatment court, you still go to jail for repeat drunk driving because that's mandatory. But when you're in jail from day one, you start receiving treatment services, and then you're slowly given more release privileges to go to treatment. You're tested daily or every few days for alcohol. There's mandatory counseling. You appear in front of that judge every week and answer for your behavior. You're rewarded if you're making progress, and you're given a consequence, typically a few days in jail, if you don't follow through with your obligations. So people have come through these treatment courts. At the end, they have a graduation ceremony. Lives are changed. You know, people are restored to being productive members of society, and they're working around the state and around the country. In fact, there's, you know, studies and research that tells us that if you do it right, it works. I should mention, Kate, we have information on our court website, wicourts.gov. Under programs, there's a description that has many details about treatment courts and other problem-solving courts and what the research is that tells us how well they work.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Mark is with us from Baraboo this morning. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking the call. Director, I'm calling in part because of course, concerns about coronavirus and how that ties into our circumstances of incarceration, and you referenced earlier the numbers of people in prison and how that's reflective of how we're approaching crime. I work in the court system, and one thing that I'm concerned about is even though we've put a lot of money into technology, we still have circumstances where we're arresting people and making them appear in person in courts. Can technology be utilized and leveraged so that we can have people appear in different jurisdictions, perhaps, and so we don't have incarceration holding people on warrants when otherwise we don't have to have them in custody, potentially exposing them to health circumstances that are negative? And also, as we look at things, mandatory arrests and incarceration for people on low-level offenses, marijuana offenses, nonviolent offenders, we're still incarcerating them. Can the director of state courts take a position on advocating for greater use of technology so that these nonviolent charged people may not have to see incarceration?
Mark, I want to pause there so the judge has time to respond to you. First on COVID-19, Judge Koshnick.
Yes. Now, I have to be careful. I don't take positions on potentially political issues like mandatory arrest and different laws. That's an executive legislative function. Courts administer cases. So I'm limited to, you know, efficient operation of the courts, protecting individual rights and providing due process. But yes, we do have video conference systems in many courtrooms around the state, and we use those frequently to allow perhaps defendants who are in custody in a distant location to appear the same day or the day following their arrest by video rather than sitting in jail and waiting perhaps 3 or 4 days for a sheriff's deputy to drive up to the other county and bring them back to court. We have lawyers who appear by video conferencing frequently. These are systems that are installed by each county, so it can vary from county to county. And the court system also does have some software that allows for video conferencing to take place. Now, related back to the Constitution, we need to make sure the courts are accessible to the public and the media. So you can't just do a private phone conference to resolve a case. You need to have equipment in the courtroom that's publicly accessible so any member of the public can walk into any courtroom in the state and observe how the court is conducting business.
Well, Judge, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Randy Koshnick has been director of the Wisconsin court system since 2017. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.